Writers concentrate on the second aspect, others on the first. No doubt the second is more crucial, but the first may not be overlooked. Taken as a spontaneous and ambivalent tendency that anticipates reason and free choice, concupiscence is a loss of integrity, because by it man is deprived that instinctive urge to what is good, which presumably he had, and he would have had he not fallen. Integrity then would mean that man's appetite was not morally freewheeling as it now is, and less still did it have any bias towards what is bad. More important, however, is the perjurance of our appetitive drives. They just continue after we've decided it's bad and don't want it. It is here that many theologians would place the essence of concupiscence. Now, we've said a lot before we got to this point. In order to clarify what this means, we can set up in sequence what happens whenever we make a free and deliberate decision. First, before I make an act of free choice, there must precede spontaneous urge or desire. This is inevitable because we are human beings. We are not God. God has no desires. Second, as I choose, I want to put everything in me into that choice. In existential terms, when a man makes a free decision, issuing from his self-determining faculty, he wants to shape and stamp his whole being into the act. He aims to throw everything he has into that choice. He wants to call forth the whole of his being so that the full ego might respond to or correspond to the decision. If he had his way, there would be no pockets of resistance, no fears, no failures or miscalculations, no uncontrolled urges. But, number three, in spite of my best efforts, the decision I make always falls short of what I want to achieve. I never succeed in ordering and mastering myself throughout the whole sweep and range of my being. I cannot make everything in me answer to my personal decision, and the adjective personal is important. Complete success is failed by a dualism. There's a split in the structure of my very existence. Some theologians call this the dualism of nature and person. I'm using technical terms. I know we've got only one more day for the seminar. I don't want to leave here without sharing this with you. This dualism of nature and person is not the familiar distinction that we're accustomed to. This is a brand new idea in theology. We better know something about this if we're going to make sense of original sin, and I think in teaching it, even in grammar school. We won't use all of these polysyllabic terms, but if we're going to profit from the developments of theology, we better understand what theology is trying to say. In this case, nature is taken as the whole given that we have, all that we are, prior to a free decision. The whole of my being, prescinding from our free and deliberate choice, person, is understood as the power and the act of my decision, the exercise of liberty. I can never put the whole of myself into anything I do. In practice, we find that no matter how we exert ourselves in any deliberate act, we are constantly thwarted and withstood by the obstinacy of our nature. It is said that we may trace the roots of this fundamental dualism to man's composition of matter and spirit. In any case, the struggle is there, and it is on this deep level that theologians are trying to explain what's wrong with man since he fell. I think, sisters, it is 11:15. What would you think of this? I have the second to the last question. We want to look at is monogenism. Monogenism, or the belief that the present human race descended from a single human pair, is the accepted teaching in the church. But in recent years, polygenism has been proposed as a possible alternative in view of certain findings in the natural sciences. As commonly proposed, polygenism became a theory on the basis of evolution, with three lines of suggested development. It's been said, the human race now existing has come from different phyla, different classes. Although coming from a single phylum or class, it has taken the step towards hominization, a new term, from the animal to the human stage, in different places or at different moments of time. In other words, different human beings came into existence in different places. Or the mechanism of the evolving process required that it be accomplished in more than one pair. The first and second are not so serious, and it's the third really that raises the problem. The third possibility may be stated in the words of Chardin, writing in 1930, quoting him, "For reasons of probability, science left to itself would never dream of attributing so narrow a base to the enormous edifice of the human race as just two individuals." Unquote, Chardin. Since that time, most evolutionists have come to believe that a major step in evolution, as postulated by the rise of man, is realized through an accumulation of minor changes that are aggregated and stabilized by natural selection. This theory would demand that not only a few individuals, but an entire population had developed along certain lines. If this hypothesis proved to be accurate, then the monogenetic origin of the human race could be explained only as an exception to the kingdom of nature, one theory. However, a growing number of scientists are expressing doubts about this theory. They feel that the origin of a new form would rather be explained by a macro change, a macro mutation, a sudden transformation of the entire equilibrium of a living organism. Let me tell you, without quoting at length, the best author whom I have found to explain how monogenism can be sustained on strict scientific lines. It is Piet Smulders, S-M-U-L-D-E-R-S. His book, The Design of Teilhard de Chardin, published in 1967, and specifically page 195. My own closing comments. Although the subject of polygenism has received much attention in recent years, you know that it was more than just an Adam and an Eve, that Adam is to be taken only as a symbol for many original pairs. Although the subject of polygenism has received a lot of attention in recent years, its practical impact on theology is minor. A number of theories have been devised to explain original sin, if ever polygenism were found to be certain. Their common problem is to account for two doctrinal principles: mankind's universal necessity of redemption, even those who had not personally sinned, and the transmission of sin from ancestors to progeny by something more than Pelagian bad example. And in my judgment, not only is monogenism the accepted teaching of the church, it is the only one that can ever be squared either with soteriology or with a theology of grace. Finally, a word on evolution and primitive man. While the subject has been treated in the parallel set of concepts that we've given on original sin, it deserves at least a few moments' attention. The question is how to square the supposedly extraordinary gifts possessed by the first parents of the human race with the evolutionary theory which supposes that man's earliest condition was primitive. Evolutionism assumes that the earlier is less perfect than the later, so that the earliest would be the least perfect. The problem on the face of it seems obvious. If the earliest ancestors of the human race were undeveloped, here's the dilemma. How can we still say that mankind at the beginning was gifted beyond even its present possession? The dilemma seems to be between accepting an evolutionary theory of man's origins on scientific grounds and rejecting such a theory on theological grounds. Actually, the issue is not crucial, but it does deserve some comment. First, man's original justice with its gifts of grace is para-historical. It belongs to the realm of faith, and as such, does not come under the scrutiny of natural science, whose unique concern is with phenomena. Secondly, stress should be placed on the transient character of whatever gifts man may have possessed at the beginning of his existence. An evolutionary theory of man's origin holds that at some primordial point of time, man derived from an animal. So what? Provided man for at least a very short time had been extraordinarily gifted, it could well be that his condition after the fall might square with the condition we find in primitive man. Third, theories of evolution give us many new insights into reality. They must be balanced, however, with certain facts of experience and faith, which cannot be left out of account. Among these facts is the very well-known experience of human freedom. As free agents, men are able to cooperate with the process, ignore it, or even act against it. The only human race of which science has any knowledge is the human race which actually exists. It does not pretend to know about other possible human races that might have been if some contrary to fact condition had been fulfilled. When the Christian faith comes along and says that mankind's historical condition has opened to science is not the one originally intended by God, science may be interested, but it tells the philosopher and theologian that is their business, not the business of the paleontologist. His concern is with the factual, not with the hypothetical. What is the hypothesis for the Christian believer? And with this we close. It is the supposition. We don't know what kind of a human race there might have been. But Christianity is built on both a fact and a hypothesis. The fact that man sinned, and this is what we've got. And a hypothesis that if mankind had not sinned, somewhere at the beginning of its history, and mankind may have existed in its primordial sinless state for as little as 5 seconds. But if he had not sinned somewhere at the beginning of his history, the history of mankind would have been different. The Christian faith then believes what no amount of scientific analysis could prove, that originally created freedom entered human history to change its course in a way that we now experience as a conflict within our very being. If there has been development since man came on the scene, this progress is both understandable and encouragement. It gives us grounds for still further human development in ages to come. On the other hand, whatever progress may take place, it entirely prescinds from what Revelation teaches us, that before recordable history, man had suffered a terrible loss, a loss of that which God had originally intended us to have, and that except for this prehistoric deviation from the divine will, the course of history would have been otherwise. And that is it. That's a correct distinction. I would add, and I don't think we can get too much insight on the difference between nature and grace, too much rests on the distinction. Nature, as the word implies, and even spells out etymologically, natura is that with which we are nati, with which we are born. It's what we come into the world with. Of course, we've got to grow, but grace is everything else we need to reach God. And that's plenty. Now, there's another distinction. Nature, taken broadly, is that, of course, with which we are born. It is also, theologically, all that God owes us once he decided, which he didn't have to do, to make us human beings. so that over and above what we are born with, all that we have a right to, thus the world around us, the sun, moon, and stars, the vegetation, other human beings, and so on, all that we need to develop, both in body and spirit, is nature. Consequently, nature theologically can be defined as that which is due to man as man. Now, the moment you use a verb like due with God, that's D-U-E, of course, we've got to be careful because, strictly speaking, God owes us nothing. Nevertheless, once he decides to create, he doesn't just create, period. He creates for a purpose. And consequently, all that a creature needs, given its nature, is what God owes it in order to reach the destiny of that nature, and that is, speaking theologically, the natural. What then is the supernatural? Now, the essence of the supernatural begins and also ends with the hypothesis, which faith affirms, that over and above what normal, natural destiny a man might have had, God has destined him for the possession of himself, that is of God, for the knowing God as God knows himself, for the loving God as God loves himself, and what is best, for being happy with a happiness that God enjoys himself. Now, that kind of destiny, simply, by definition, couldn't be. It isn't just that it wasn't. It couldn't be natural to any creature. God could not, though he is God, create a nature, that is a creative nature, which would have a right to his divine happiness. Well, he wouldn't be God, right? The only one who has a right to divine happiness is God. Having decided, however, to create the angelic and the human beings, and then having further decided, which he didn't have to. See, he didn't have to destine us for his happiness. No more than he had to destine an acorn for ever having a thought. He might have stopped. Nice acorn makes a nice tree. When it grows to maturity, it grows acorns and the thing starts over again. See, God could have stopped anywhere. And he could have stopped with us human beings as human beings. Rather intelligent acorns, but still we would have been human beings with such limitations as are intrinsic to created nature. Once he decided that intelligent beings, he would allow one day and invite them to one day possess himself, to enjoy him as God enjoys himself, he had to do something with his nature. We call it elevated. He had to, therefore, give man the capacity for reaching that to which God had freely destined him. All the means which are requisite, over and above what man has as man, which would have been enough to reach some kind of a destiny, but not the one which he is now created for, all of that is grace. Question 2. What are some popular current misconceptions about original sin? Here I really did want help because I have some in my stockpot and I thought I'd find a few more. For example, A denial of original sin by saying that all evil is heredity or environmental. Okay? Now notice that distinction we made this morning between original sin, original to nature, and original to person. Original at the beginning of the human race. Original at the beginning of me. Now, of course, we all consider ourselves the most important part of the human race. But that's beside the point. There are two origins. One for the race and one for me. Now, the church teaches that human nature, the human race, has an original sin. It is sinful just because it is human. But human subsequent to the fall. But then we pick up another original sin. In fact, all kinds of sins, both in terms of background and in terms of the environment into which we are born. In other words, and this is in talking to people, especially some who write on the subject, I tell them, if only you didn't deny the other, what's wrong with why, I ask them. Do you say that the only original sin is that which is heredity or environmental? They don't know. Except that somehow their faith has been dimmed. So it's both. Secondly, denying the possibility of original sin's transmission by concluding that such a transmission would be unjust. Says who? If we could have been acorns or apples or water, the water in that pitcher has no more right to be water than I have to be me. Unjust. Who made everything? Anytime a person uses the word unjust where God is concerned, he's talking nonsense. I tell people like that, your problem is not theological, it's psychological. Moreover, a proper understanding of what original sin is, and this may be part of the person's trouble. He's just using wrong words to express confused ideas. That inasmuch as God never had to create man to begin with, number one. Secondly, having created him, and here we admit, God in justice to himself owes it to himself, not to man. God owes man nothing. But justice to himself, God owes man the means which man would need to reach his natural human destiny. Okay, so what? So what's this got to do with original sin? Nothing. Because the essence of original sin is that God had originally given man two things, both his nature plus this extraordinary supernatural destiny. And God does assure man, even with original sin, all the means requisite. In other words, he didn't deprive him of his free will. Here's capacity for thinking straight. The problem behind that question is there's a Calvinist mentality lurking behind it. That's the question I ask Calvin or his followers. It's unjust on the part of God if man, having sinned primordially, which none of us had anything to do with, he now, because of Adam's sin, would condemn us to hell. But who says that God is doing that? We simply are deprived of that which we had no right to in the first place. Third, stressing that man is naturally good, incapable of any sin. Well, I guess there are some who say that. They ought to get around. Read the Chicago Tribune for 1 week and they would be disillusioned about man's being naturally good. Fourth, blaming original sin for every evil, a determined existence, no freedom. Now this is, I think, a real problem. When we mentioned sometime earlier in the seminar about the culture in which we are living in the United States not being Catholic, but, frankly, of Protestant vintage, this has deeply affected Western thought. A book, by the way, I think his first name is William. The last name is, I know, Fuller. And the title of the book, I think, is Man in Modern Fiction. Any of you read him? Fuller's Man in Modern Fiction. The man is certainly not a Catholic. I think he's a Christian. It's one of the most perceptive books that I've read, analyzing perhaps 50 modern novels, bestsellers, and showing how practically every one of them has such a dark, macabre, dungeon-like concept of human nature. You want to crawl into a hole and die. Pessimism. Stark pessimism. And he blames a lot of it on Calvin, more accurately, on the Manichaean tendency in all human beings. Fifth, predestination. Man is either saved or damned. No amount of effort can help him. Yes. Again, this is not what original sin is. Sixth, denial of the possibility of preternatural gifts. Man never had them, and thus had nothing to lose. All right, that's Pelagianism. And when I teach the matter, I tell my students that we